Hello, and welcome to the Beacon Group's Noon Step Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Kirsten, and I'm an alcoholic. In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speakers, you will not be able to unmute yourself during the meeting. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Yay, preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend, but we ask that only alcoholics participate. If you're new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we strongly recommend home group membership and sponsorship. And if you're new or not so new and you're looking for a new sponsor, please put your name and number in the chat. If you've worked all 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, have had a spiritual experience, and you're willing to sponsor, please also put your name and number in the chat. The chat will remain open during the meeting, except while the speaker is sharing. And also in the chat, you'll find our AA quote of the day. The quote source will always be from AA literature. Today, our speaker will share for 30 minutes on the step of the day, and then we're going to split into breakout rooms for small group discussions. Each group has a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. And when you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussions end at 12:54, followed by day counts, announcements, and the Lord's Prayer. And I have asked Lee to read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lee?
Holy alcoholic. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made it three is that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for the knowledge of their will for us and have the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Lee, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Today, we will hear talk on steps 8 and 9. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So please welcome Devin C. from Brooklyn, New York. Devin?
All right. Good morning or afternoon or whatever time it happens to be, wherever you guys are at. My name is Devin. I'm a recovered alcoholic. It's good to see you. I'm going to make sure I can see everybody now. There we go. I do have a home group, and I do live in Brooklyn, New York. My home group is called No Serenity Till Brooklyn. If you ever find yourself out this way, we're kind of close to Grand Army Plaza, a little bit in the middle. We have four meetings a week, and I'm usually at least two of them. The Sunday morning beginners meeting and our Monday night big book speaker meeting. And I have a sobriety date, which is August 28th of 2011. And I'm definitely a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really happy to get to talk about steps 8 and 9. I sometimes feel like if I'm telling my story, I'll get to this part of the steps and realize I don't have a lot of time, but there's a lot of stuff that I always want to talk about around the amends that I don't really get to. So it's nice that we're just kind of talking around the amends portion of our program. Before I jump into that, you know, I have this thing where if somebody just kind of starts giving a thing where we're on a topic and that's it, and they don't qualify in any kind of way about their drinking, that I kind of tune out. And so in a very brief, general way, what I need you guys to understand is when I say I'm an alcoholic, what I mean is really simple. I was talking to a guy last night, a buddy of mine, he just can't get a day sober. And I know what that's like. And I know what it's like to wake up every morning and say, I need to get sober, and to come to meetings for almost every day for 3 months and say to myself, I need to get sober. I need to do this, and find myself at some point every one of those days taking a drink against my will. I know what that's like. I know how dark it is when you can't stop, but you want to stop. And I got brought to that place about 12 years ago today. I was just starting that journey. It was early June 2011 when I actually came to a meeting on my own. I was suicidal. I was 24 years old, and I had no idea how to live life. And there was a part of me that wanted to kill myself, and there was a part of me that wanted to live. And it's kind of a weird place to be in. You know, the alcohol was not taking away the pain anymore. It was not allowing me to feel comfortable in my own skin. It was not allowing me to feel like I could go out and join the world and be a part of life. I was just stuck in this cycle where the best I could do was wake up, try to hobble over to a meeting, hope that something that you guys were saying would rub off on me and that I'd maybe be able to get a day sober. And at some point, you know, I would start taking a drink. And once I start taking a drink, you know, they've never had a governor on the thing. From the first time I ever drank, I drank to get drunk. I've never thought that, you know, this was about having a social experience of just like have a drink and go home. I mean, I every time I drank, it was, I want to feel it. I'm going to drink as much as I can, as fast as I can. And that's just kind of how I rolled from, you know, when I started drinking at 12 or 13, as often as I could, until when I got struck sober, which was August 28th of 2011. And, you know, so I have that physical thing that we talk about. I have that once alcohol's in my system, something happens. I can't stop. I don't have control over that. I don't know what's going to happen. Some nights it would be manageable and I would have some other interest that would show up and I wouldn't have the crazy 2 weeks where I'm in a blackout. But then some days I take a drink with all intentions of just having a, you know, a mellow night out with some friends, and I wind up 3 days later coming to on my floor and I don't know what happened. And I definitely have the mental obsession piece, which is the powerlessness in my mind, which prevented me from ever really being able to change my relationship to alcohol. Everything I ever tried to do in order to put a wedge between me and that, or to change our relationship, it just never worked. And today I understand that that's because I really suffered from this deep internal discomfort and this brokenness in my soul, you know, and alcohol fixed that at an early age, you know, and it gave me an opportunity to feel like I was okay in my own skin and to feel like I could talk to you and be a part of life and participate. And all of a sudden I had found this amazing way to allow me to feel comfortable in my own skin, which I believe is where that mental obsession was born out. You know, so I claim my alcoholism, and I understand today that really it's a spiritual problem. It's a me problem. It shows up as a drinking problem, but it's not an alcohol problem. It's a spiritual problem. And thank God we have a program here that is a spiritual program that's sole focus is to develop a relationship with us and the thing that we seem to call God and a higher power, and allow us to clear away whatever debris is standing in my heart between me and having a relationship with the God of my understanding. So I came to you guys. I couldn't stop. I got invited into the fellowship. You know, if you go to a bunch of meetings and you say you're new, people give you their phone number. They'll take you out. You'll have an omelet in front of you at a diner. you know, they'll feed you, they'll give you their phone numbers, they'll tell you where they're going to be, and they'll invite you in. That's what happened to me. And as I said, for 3 months, I got invited into the fellowship, and I was waiting to blackout almost every single night. The day that I got struck sober was the day I walked into a room and I said, I'm screwed and I don't know what to do. You know, it was the first time I heard myself tell the truth, which is the best I can do is I'll be drunk and high later. If it's up to me, I will be drunk and high later. But I'd watched other people get sober over that time, and I had some belief. Oh my God, is that Heidi? Hello, Heidi. Wow. I miss you, my friend. Coming to AA for 3 months, what I had seen was other people stay sober when I couldn't. So I'd come to believe that AA could work for you. And so I had this really amazing surrender moment on August 28th of 2011, where I just said, if I'm not surrounded by you people, I know I'm going to be drunk and high later. It's going to happen. It's been happening every single night. And I hadn't planned on saying that. It was kind of like I heard myself say it. Like I was an observer to what was happening in the room. And we stood up and we said the serenity prayer to close the meeting. And I got that little tingle down my spine feeling. And for me, that feeling has just kind of represented like, this is for you, you know? And so here I am with no God, with, you know, nothing in my life, basically being burnt to the ground, suicidal at 24 years old with no work, no opportunity to go and have any kind of real future, it looks like. About to have to maybe get kicked out of my apartment and live in my car. And I got this little message that I was in the right place in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only thing I've done since then to today is I've made it a priority to just be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and do everything that is asked of me here. And I really am not the same person, and I have been changed. And I can tell you that's what this program is ultimately about. This is a program of change. This isn't a program of get your old life back and fix yourself. I mean, this is a program of the person that I was that walked in the door that was incapable of staying sober literally has to go die. You know, and I don't mean physically. I mean, like the ego and the selfishness and the way that I was approaching life was not working for me. And I had to really go at that. And so if you're looking at our steps and you're new, you know, that was how I admitted I was powerless, came to believe that there was a power greater than myself, and ultimately made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God. And it came through coming to meetings and being unable to stop, watching you guys stay sober, and finally coming to a moment where I was surrendered and was able to start actually hearing what was really going on. You know, I don't have time to go through everything else, but I guess you guys had 6 and 7 yesterday. I'm assuming you had 4 and 5, you know, maybe at the end of last week. But, you know, we do this inventory stuff, and the inventory stuff is an opportunity for me to start looking at how I've really, you know, how do I react to you that doesn't work for me is really what it is. I learned that I can't blame you for how I feel, that the world is kind of being the world. And perhaps I need to take the understanding that the world is perfect. If God is everything, then God is everything. And the problem is my reaction to the world. And so in the inventory stuff, I got to learn about how I show up in relationship with God's kids, and in relationship with myself, with fear, and with, you know, intimate relationships, you know. So I got a chance to look at this stuff and see, here's how I show up that doesn't work for me. I found out I'm a really arrogant, prideful, indignant guy. I'm really afraid. I really want you to like me. I want you to see me a certain way. You know, I started to get armed with, this is how I show up that actually causes me to be uncomfortable in my own skin. And the amazing thing is, over the years, I've written a lot of inventory. I've heard a lot of inventory. There's not much of a shock or a surprise in that anymore. I mean, we really are all very similar. We are way more similar than we are different when you get down to our humanness. And that's what writing inventory has shown me over and over again, is the names of who did what to me change. What they did to me is a little bit different, but my reaction to them is almost the same every time. And the more I see that, the more I start to understand that this is how I show up and how I might be causing damage to those around me. That doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for anybody around me, which is why they're getting angry and they're starting to do things that look like I'm the victim and all that stuff. So big plug for the inventory process is not to be missed. And they mentioned in the inventory process that part of this amends deal, this 8-step, which I'll read one more time, is we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. They say, you know, remember, we made that when we took inventory. And you go, wait a sec, I was inventorying all the people that I'm angry at and my fears and my partners and my intimate relationships. What do you mean I made a list of all the people I had harmed? And what I want to reiterate in that is not everybody on that list I have harmed. You know, just because I'm angry at you does not mean I harmed you. But chances are, if I go through that inventory and I take a look at my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my self-seeking, the way I showed up and the way I was behaving and treating people, especially in the conduct relationship and intimate personal relationships, when I start looking at that stuff, I am going to find harm that I've caused other people there. And so it's a great, I you know, some people say burn the inventory when it's done and have the whole ceremonial, like we're going to send it off to sea. And if you want to do that, that's great. But like, make sure you got a copy of it because you're going to need it. You know, I read inventory to a lot of people that I write. I don't burn, I keep it all. You know, when I'm sponsoring somebody and I'm going to show them how to write the stuff, I'm going to read some inventory to them and show them this is what I wrote a couple months ago. So, you know, but I'm going to probably find some damage that I've done in there. And some of these amends will be in there. So here's the deal for me. You know, the inventory stuff is I get to learn about me. And I get to have this amazing conversation with a sponsor, and maybe some other friends and spiritual guides through the deal. And that's like, you have this kind of amazing experience. I had a tremendous experience doing the fifth step. And my buddy Lenny said it best. And they say it in our literature, you know, they go, you know, these people that we got to go make amends to, he goes, he's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. You know, if I've stolen $500 from you, I don't think you really care that I've had this amazing spiritual moment of writing inventory and sharing it with somebody else. You know, my buddy Lenny is like, up until 8 and 9, what you really had is a couple of cups of coffee and some nice conversations with your sponsor. But nobody else outside of AA really cares. You know, 8 and 9 is really an opportunity for us to begin a process of healing. And so I have a lot of stories I want to talk about of some of the experiences I've had. But I want to say this, I think sometimes we do go a little nuts. We really need to find out who we've harmed. You know, I have a couple of guys that I've, you know, friends of mine that are old timers, guys I've sponsored, I've been working with for a bunch of years now, you know, I've had people come up to them at an AA meeting and say, hey, can I talk to you after the meeting? I owe you an amends. Oh, yeah, sure. And they get pulled over and some AA member comes up to them and just says, you know, for the last 5 years, I thought you were just the biggest jerk and I just hated you. And I just, I can see I was wrong and I don't hate you anymore. And they're like, okay. Like, they, you know, my friends that have had people make those kind of amends where they had no idea that there was any kind of person that was sitting in the back room just judging them and disliking them. They're like, it didn't really make me feel good. They're changed, you know, it really was, I don't understand it. You know, so I think we need to look at, like, if I've just sat around and harbored ill will towards you, but I've just never really had a conversation with you and you're just like a member of the home group that like, we just don't cross paths. I'm not sure I've harmed you. You know, could I be friendly and cordial and maybe come and just say, hey, it's nice to see you. How you doing? You know, I realize we just never really say hi and just wanted to say hello. Sure. But do I need to pull you off to the side and be like, you know, I just thought you were the biggest a-hole. Like, probably not. I don't know what good that brings about. But what they start to speak to in our book is that we've probably caused some separation and damage in the world with other people. And that's what we really need to look for. One of the things that I think is super important is to, you know, when I'm getting ready to look at this list of where I've caused harm, is to go back through my life of people that I've known, from friends to family, coworkers, roommates, you know, all the institutions that we attended or were involved with, and start to consider, like, do I have separation or like some kind of you know, is there something between me and these people? You know, and maybe I don't know exactly what the harm is, but I can generally know if there's some kind of a weird vibe or separation between me and somebody else. Now, sometimes it's super easy. I mean, I stole from this guy, I stole from that guy, you know, obviously with my family, you know, they got a bunch of calls from jail, not a bunch, they got, you know, the clerk call from jail, they got some calls from some police officers, they bailed me out, you know, they got like the highlight reel, because I was kind of halfway across the country while they were in the Midwest, and all they would really get is the phone rings and it's the police calling my parents, telling them what's going on with their son, you know? So I definitely had a lot of damage that happened in the family. And I think everybody, if you really sit back and look, is going to find out that there's a lot of damage in one way or the other with the family. One of the things that I consider, well, so let's talk about this. Step 8 just says we made a list of all persons we had harmed. That's number one. So if I'm approaching step 8 and I just need something to do, the first thing is I just need a list. Just like I need a list of all people I'm pissed off at and resentful at in the fourth step, like the beginning of the eighth step, let's just write a list of names of people that we're clear on that we have caused some harm to. And the good news for me, at least, is I usually tend to know, I know who I've stolen from. You know, I know who I've told off in the street and, you know, said F you and middle finger. Like I have a recollection a lot of the time of those moments in my life where I did things that I'm not proud of and I'm not ashamed of, and I potentially, you know, have caused some damage. And so I just need to start that list. And the way I consider harm is I consider kind of three things. Number one is like financial. You know, I either owe you money, I stole something from you that, you know, I took something that wasn't mine, or I, you know, I've got an outstanding debt that I haven't been good on paying, something like that. You know, the other one I consider is physical. Did I ever cause physical harm to somebody? Did I get literally in a fight? Did I cause property damage? Did I do something that's like actually an act of aggression of some kind of physical form of violence? And the one that I think is probably the deepest and the one that might take the most reflection, I would call it emotional or spiritual harm. You know, and this is really where I look at like the family. You know, what kind of damage did I really do to my family? You know, it's kind of unclear to me how many nights my parents might have stayed up talking about what they might be able to do to try to help their son. I don't know. You know, my buddy Mike and I, we talk about how we can be emotional terrorists, that we can hold people hostage by literally being alcoholics and throwing mood swings at them so they're always off balance. And the way that we live our lives is so self-obsessed that we'll be gaslighting people, we'll make them feel like they're crazy when we're crazy. You know, we can really cause a lot of damage emotionally and spiritually to people. And I think that's kind of how I tend to think about is like, I go back through my life and it's like, where have I done some of this? You know, where do I see this? And so my number one job on 8 is I got to make the list. Now, I believe that the 8th step is really the workhorse of these two steps. A lot of people, everyone seems to be worried about 9. Oh my God, I actually have to go talk to these people and try to see what we can do. But what I'm going to tell you is this, the second half of the 8th step, in my opinion, became willing to make amends to them all. That's really the work. That is the moment where I have an opportunity to take some action. Because if I'm not willing to make the amends, then 9 is impossible. I'm definitely not going and making the amends if I'm not willing to do that. But the minute that I become willing to make an amends, I'm willing to pick up that phone and try to reach out to somebody and set up an appointment to meet them. You know, I'm actively talking with my sponsor or some other spiritual advisors about, here's the situation. Do you know anybody that might have some kind of experience? Do you have any experience with this? How might I be able to approach this situation and how can we make it right? You know, if I'm engaging in that kind of a situation, I'm already seeing that I'm pretty willing to make the amends. But if I've got somebody and I go, screw that guy, I'm definitely not, you know, that guy deserves, you know, he was way worse than me, then I'm actually not willing to make that amends. And I think that's where we can do some work. I want to read a couple of things. I want to read. So when we start talking about this, and if you're new and you're going, what are we talking about amends? You know, number one is I got to repair, you know, the simplest explanation for me is if I harmed you, I owe you. That this is kind of like if I had a spiritual balance sheet in the world. This is an opportunity for me to balance the books, that I need to own up to how I've really been living. And I need to go to the people that I've caused damage in their lives and actually take an interest in seeing if I can help them heal from me. The book says something else. It says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. And they give us this thing a couple of times. They go, remember, you agreed that you'd go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And that the way we're going to get victory over alcohol is that we fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. And we develop a real relationship with the God of our understanding. And so the suggestion that, as I see it, is that this is all about me getting closer to God. This is about me having some more humility and some and surrendering a little bit more and trusting the process that either God is or God isn't. And this program either works or it doesn't. And what I'm being asked to do here is to reach out to the people directly that I've harmed and engage in a conversation with them and ask them, is there anything that I can actually do in order to try to repair the damage that I caused in your life? How can I allow you to heal from what I've done to you? And I think that I have experienced this, and I know a bunch of people that have, but I believe we get those promises in the eighth step. Once I'm willing to make the amends, I really believe that those promises start showing up. You know, I have to go make the amends, but when I get to make the amends, that's when those promises can start showing up in the other person's lives. So I want to tell a couple of stories. You know, I went and I talked to my family, and I didn't talk to my family right away because I didn't get sponsored through the big book super quick. It was, you know, a whole thing. The first couple of years, I was a little bit, you know, I found a guy, we read the 12 and 12. And, you know, by the time I talked to my family for real and made an actual approach and a formal amends, it was 2 years sober. Now, in those 2 years, I had been having a conversation with them. They knew I was sober. You know, I was living different, but we actually approached this formalized conversation. And I surprised them. I showed up right on my anniversary. It was my sister's birthday and my anniversary, like 3 days apart. I surprised my parents. They didn't know I was coming, flew in for my sister's birthday to Indiana. And we got to sit one night and I got to have a conversation with them. And it simply was, you know, hey, I don't know how I could ever make this right between us, but I need you guys to know that I'm really doing this sobriety thing. I'm not just paying lips. Like, I'm really doing this. This is real. And I need to figure out what I can do to ever make it right between us. Because there was just so much stuff. And with some tears in their eyes, they just looked at me and they said, we just want our son back. That's all we've ever wanted is for you to be happy, for you to go out in the world and live this life that we see is available to you, you know, to be a part of our lives and to just be happy. And I was probably four years ago now. And I was having a conversation with my mom on the phone, just driving home. And offhandedly, she said this to me. She said, you know, you were probably 5 years sober. And one night the landline rang a little too late, like the 2000, this is like 2016. Who's calling a landline like past 9 o'clock, you know, or a landline in general. Everyone's got cell phones. The house phone rang at 9 something at night. And my mom said it was the first time that I didn't get that sinking pit of my stomach feeling that something was wrong with you. You know, and what she allowed me to understand there was, yeah, I got sober. At 2 years sober, we had this formal conversation. I checked off the amends box with my sponsor. We did the family, you know, done. But it still took somewhere between that moment and another 3 years before my mom had actually healed from the damage that I inflicted to her. Had I not actually continued to live differently, had I not actually shown up and tried to practice the rest of this program, to get involved in sponsorship, to get involved in service, to make it my business, to be an AA member in good standing, who's trying to help others and live this program, and I'm not continuing to grow and change, I don't know if my mom actually heals from the conversation alone. And I think we put this premium on, I have to go talk to these people, and I lied to you, I'm sorry. But if the next week I'm out there lying to 10 other people, it's like, did that conversation I had with the one person really amount to much? You know, what this is really suggesting, as I understand it, is that as much as I need to go to the people that I've harmed, I need to have those conversations. If I stole from you, I need to go to you and let you know, hey, I stole from you. This is what I took. You know, what can I do to make that right? And I need to get clear with that. You know, with our romantic partners, if you were married to somebody, if you live with someone for a while, we got to have a conversation. There's some stuff there. You know, if I had a one night fling with somebody and I can't remember their name, is there really an amends there? I don't know. You know, but like, there's clearly going to be people in our lives that we've had relationships with that have gotten destroyed by our alcoholism and our behavior. And we absolutely have to have conversation with those people if they will see us. And as I was instructed to go into them, it's like direct amends is to the people we harmed. You know, it's not like, well, I got criminal charges, so I got to just go talk to the judge. It's like, no, I need to go talk to the person that's putting those charges up. You know, I mean, and for me, it came into like, I'd stolen from a drug dealer. I was working for him, and I'd stolen like a quarter pound of pot for him one time, or from him one time, which would be like $1,500. I don't know. I can't remember, but it was a chunk of money. It was like years later, and it popped into my brain. I forgot about it, and I called Bart, and I said, what do I do with this? And he just goes, if it was an electrical bill, you'd pay it, right? I said, yeah, you know? And I reached out to this guy and was able to have a conversation with him and say, look, man, like all those years ago when I was working for you, one day you'd forgotten to put your books right. And I, is that five? Amazing. You know, I walked out of there with like $1,500 worth of, you know, stuff that I didn't pay for. And, you know, and I had this opportunity to start reaching out to those people that I had taken stuff from and reaching out to, you know, early on it was going to friends. You know, I put a lot of friends in a lot of really dangerous places because I was driving them around all wasted, or because they were hanging out with me, I was accelerating kind of the path of their lives. And I got to have all these conversations with people, and I had funny things. Like I'm setting up to play at a small club, and my friend Melissa comes walking in because she played there the night before and she forgot something from her saxophone. And I literally, like, because I at that point was open and willing to do this, like I was setting up, I saw her, she saw me. I literally like put everything down before I was going to play, ran out of the club and caught her on the sidewalk and was like, hey, do you have a minute? You know, because I need to talk to you because of what had happened between us. And she was dating a guy and we were all just in a totally bad way. And she was really, it was just, I caused a lot of damage to her. But I had these moments of getting set free, and not because I was getting set free, but I had the moments of like going to other people and finding out that I could either do something or I didn't need to do something because they'd forgiven me, and was able to start putting to rest this idea that like I had all this unfinished business in the world. You know, they say the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it, but that doesn't mean I don't go to the people and have that conversation. And I hear that a lot too. I'm making living amends on these. And it's like, well, what is a living amends? You know, what I have to do is I have to actually change. So I have to live this way of life and invite God to change me in order for me to be changed. That's my, you know, that's my experience. If my life is unmanageable, I can't just fix me. So I don't have the power to sit down and go, I'm just going to stop lying now. I'm going to stop stealing. You know, like I've had to go to my higher power and ask to be changed. And with some people, you can't get a hold of them, right? They don't answer the phone, or they ignore us. There's some, I have one person that just said, stay away from me and don't ever talk to me again. And that became pretty clear. Like, you know, I talked to Bart about it. I said, what do I do with this one? He goes, she already told you how you can make her life better. Here, don't be a part of it. You know, pretty clear direction. You know, stay away. But I have to go and have that conversation. But the conversation is not the amends. I think that's what I'm trying to say here. The conversation for me has been the beginning of a healing process, and the actual amending of my behavior has come slowly over time as I continue to practice 10, 11, and 12. I continue to try to go back and look at an inventory, what's going on in my life, and try to address what's going on in me that causes me to be broken and feeling less than and fractured. And what I've gotten to watch is some amazing stuff. You know, my family, we're like a whole unit, you know what I mean? We don't have separation. Everybody's excited about what's going on. My mom even joined Al-Anon in the pandemic. That's crazy. She got a 3-year chip in Al-Anon earlier this year. You know, we started having conversations about God and spirituality and recovery. And then eventually she came through the avenue of virtual meeting spaces and went to some Al-Anon early in the pandemic and, you know, and decided to join and has a home group. And, you know, that's totally amazing. And then one day she came out to visit a little over a year ago, and she said, can we have some time off to the side? Because I feel like I owe you an amends. And I said, well, you don't owe me, you know, you've done nothing wrong. You don't owe me amends. Well, let's have a chat, you know. So I didn't want to rob her of the experience of getting to sit down and do this. And she came to my home group's anniversary meeting. And then we sat in my car afterwards, and she made an approach and made an amends. And what I heard was going on was that she still blamed herself for my alcoholism in some way. She kind of had this idea that that she had, if she had been a better mom, maybe I wouldn't have turned out as a drunk. And she said, what could I do to make this right? And I got to look one more time at my mom, this time from the position of being the person receiving the amends. And I got to look her in the eye and say, the only thing I need you to do is forgive yourself because you didn't cause this. And we had this amazing moment where we both realized that all the stuff I ever went through brought us to this place today, where both of us are here seeking a relationship with the God of our understanding and trying to figure out how we can come together and have some harmony in our family. You know, this is a beautiful experience. And if you're afraid of making amends, you can inventory that. You know, if you've got something that's standing between you becoming willing to do this, get with someone who's done amends of a similar nature and ask them how they got the courage and how they worked up to being willing to do this stuff. You know, there is not a situation that I think you can imagine on this earth that somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous has not had to go through and sat in front of and made it, tried to make it right. So don't let fear run your life anymore. You know, like, what is keeping me from making an amends was a great question. I got a new sponsor behind that. And I literally was like, you know, he's like, why don't you inventory any fear that's standing between you and making these amends right here, right now? You know, and he showed me that there's clearly stuff I can do if I'm unwilling to take the action in front of me. But if I want to really do the AA thing, I'm going to try to make direct amends to all the people I've harmed as best I can. I have one that I can't do or haven't been able to do. It is the one that 3 years sober after knowing this lady for 4 years, she gave me the middle finger and said, don't ever talk to me again. And it's really strange because very recently she liked the thing on Instagram. I said, that's weird. And then all of a sudden she followed me. And then there was a little emoji heart or, you know, clap or whatever on some story that I posted. And it seems really silly to me. But if this person said, stay away from me, don't ever talk to me, those little small interactions show that that door might open. And I'm just kind of watching and letting her take the lead there. But I may be able to actually make an approach and see about making an official, you know, an amends with this lady that I really hurt. But she's like the one that I haven't been able to get to so far. But everybody else that I'm aware of that I've harmed, I've done my best to try to show up and find out what can I do to allow you to heal here. And what it's given me is a sense of belonging, not just in AA, but in the world. And I can walk around and look people in the eye. And, you know, this program has allowed me to be comfortable in my own skin. Everything I looked for in a drink, I found here through living this wonderful way of life. And for a guy that came in suicidal at 24 years old, I think it's a pretty good deal. You know, I don't get to talk about like what I'm doing today. But I can tell you that I've gotten to travel all over the world. And I play on Broadway sometimes, and I get to make music for a living. And I've been doing that ever since I got struck sober. And I get to do a lot of things that a guy like me should just not be able to do. And I think it's all because of what this program asks us to do. So anyways, that's enough out of me. I hope that is in some way helpful. And I appreciate you guys for allowing me to be here. Thanks.